Good morning. My name is Ted Peters. I teach at Pacific Lutheran Seminary in Berkeley, California, and our topic is the future of the family. I got interested in this subject only secondarily. I was interested in other major economic and social problems having to do with the future when I was researching the book Fear, Faith, and the Future, copies of which are in the bookstore, and found that one of the chief sources of anxiety within our own society, I think, is trouble in the family. And so there's a little bit of what I'm going to say here in this book, Fear, Faith, and the Future, but a fair amount of what I've got to say is also material that I looked at subsequent to actually writing this book. And in doing research on the future of the family, I found myself changing my mind on a number of issues, and in some ways actually ending up with more questions than answers. I thought I knew more about the subject before I studied it than after. But I want to share with you what I think are some of the forecasts and some of the prognoses, and suggest towards the end of the presentation some specific things that I think church congregations ought to think about with regard to this subject. But you've all done a little bit of homework now. I would like to hear from you what you think a family is. Can you give me a definition of the family? What guinea pig wants to start? Yes, ma'am.
Any household with more than one person.
A family is any household with more than one person. Good. How about another definition?
Where individuals are tied together by legal or biological ties, sometimes they come together for common tasks. I was just going to write a whole bunch of things.
Okay. Individuals who are bound together either legally or biologically, or who come together to share a common task.
No. I said sometimes, based on my first sentence about biological or legal ties, they come together for common tasks.
Okay. I think I got that. Either by a biological or legal, and then sometimes for the common task. All right.
Oh, that's true.
Carol?
I didn't write down that it's, I had a group of people who lived together intentionally for mutual benefit.
A group of people who lived together intentionally for a mutual benefit. My son Paul was born into our family. He didn't have a choice. Would he count as intentional, or in other words, would he be a member of the family after he matures and could become intentional, or?
Well, has he run away today?
Nope.
Then he's intentional.
He's intentional. Okay, de facto. Okay, another definition.
I said a small group of people who live intimately with each other, being vulnerable in that intimacy. And what that means is being able to be angry and to love each other, to forgive and to be forgiven.
Okay. Your family is a small group, and intimacy seems to be the chief characteristic of the relationship. How about another definition?
A group of people brought together for common nurture, protection, and support.
A group of people brought together for common nurture, protection, and support. Would Holden Village count as
a sense,
family, in that definition?
In a sense, it's a family.
Yeah. What about the Hatfields and the McCoys? Those are two families, aren't they?
I just read a definition the other day from the American Home Economic Association.
Yes.
This is their new definition of a family. Two or more persons who share resources, share responsibility for decisions, share values and goals, and have commitments to one another over time. The family is that climate that one comes home to, and it is this network of sharing and commitments that most accurately describes the family unit, regardless of blood, legal ties, adoption, or marriage.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a very complex form of your initial definition, two or more people.
But even if they don't have a common goal or don't want to share resources, they're still a family.
If they're in the same household.
Even if they don't want to be a family, they're still a family in the same household.
All right.
I think.
have a question. We have all the definitions now have said two or more persons.
Is
one person not a family? Mm-hmm.
It sounds to me from the on the basis of the definitions that that would be the case. I would like to ask a question of these two definitions. I have a brother who lives in Michigan right now, and we have not lived together since 1959. And if present trends continue, we will probably die without ever living together again. Does he count as a member of my family? But we do not share the same household. We don't share the same income and a number of other things. One of the interesting...
Was the answer yes?
Well, I'm going to sit on the fence on that one.
Mr. Professor.
What I wanted to do with this little exercise is to show that there can be some complexities in working on the definition of the family, that the definition of the family is not a simple thing, illustrated in part by the kind of dialogue we've had, illustrated in addition by the White House Conference on the Family, which occurred towards the end of President Carter's administration, in which Carter had said that the future of the family is a top priority for American society, and thought that we would have a nice way of kicking the whole thing off by bringing together a variety of people to discuss family matters. And the convention or the conference just blew up. It was not a success, and the reason was nobody could agree on the definition of a family. So many different definitions came sailing through that particular conference. And in part, I think we have to say that one of the factors in the future of the family is that knowing what a family is going to become increasingly difficult. Biological relationship is at all important in the definition of the family, that's going to become more complex as artificial insemination and artificial inovulation become more widely practiced. Louise Brow, 1978, was the first test tube baby that was born, and her genetic makeup came from both her mother and from her father, but in principle, of course, you could purchase both the semen and the egg from other people other than the woman who actually brings the child to term, and you could raise all kinds of questions as to whose baby it is. In fact, that happened to New York, and one thing we can forecast coming down the road is that middle class and upper class couples are likely to hire poorer women to actually bear the child so that their careers will not be interrupted. This did occur in New York. And the husband and wife took their own semen and egg and placed it in a hired woman to bring it to term. When the baby was born, she decided that she didn't want to give it to the mother or the father. Went to court. Guess who won? It was the woman who carried the baby, won the case, even though she carried somebody else's baby. But on down the line, we're going to have more and more complex disputes. On the question of household... there's a difference, I think, at least I'd like to work with the difference between a family and a household. In one sociological survey of a Chicago neighborhood, they found 86 different types of households. There were some, of course, that had mother, father, and children, but others had mother, father, and aunt, two sisters and a brother. There were grandmas and grandpas. There was no single pattern of what constitutes a household. So the image of the family, or the definition of the family, difficult now, it's going to get more difficult. Another thing I discovered in doing research on the question of the future of the family, that it is tough to study the material without my thinking about my own family situation. And I suggest that you'll probably end up today thinking about your family situation as we're talking about societal patterns. And so let me tell you briefly what it is that I observe. In short, the family that I'm immediately associated with is a product of our own decision and a product of our own commitment. when Jenny and I got married, it was not a shotgun wedding. We didn't have to get married. I had grown up and had left home and was living in another city. My wife had grown up. She had graduated from college. And we met each other, decided to get married. My parents didn't even know who she was. Her parents did know who I was, did not approve particularly. The decision, they did not stand in the way. It was our decision and solely our decision. And if we were to get divorced, my wife is educated, and she could certainly take care of herself. She doesn't require a husband to get along in this particular society. There are no economic pressures that are keeping us married. And nowadays, quite different from two decades ago, it's not all that bad for a clergy person to be divorced. 27% of the Lutheran pastors in the West Coast are divorced. And not only that, I think that if I were to announce to my clergy colleagues that I was having a rough time in my marriage and that it was leading to divorce, a lot of them would put their hands on my shoulders and tell me they understand what kinds of things I'm going through. And I would get probably a lot of pastoral care and encouragement. So there's not a social stigma that is pressuring us to stay married. My wife says that when we got married, she promised and I promised that we would never get a divorce and that we plan on keeping that promise. She also reminded me that she made no promises about murder, however. The situation with our children is also a situation that is dependent entirely upon choice. We decided that we would not have any children of our own, thinking that there were enough homeless children in the world that if we were going to provide a home for anyone, we might as well provide one for a genuine need rather than creating a need all over again. And so we approached social workers about adoption, and I was a war protester during the 60s, and we sought directly to get some of the Vietnamese orphans. In the process of pursuing adoption, Jenny overcame all birth control measures that we had tried and became pregnant. And even at that point, abortion laws were becoming more and more liberalized, and the pastors in Chicago where we were living approved of abortion rather vociferously, and so we could have eliminated the child in the womb had we so chosen, but we did not. We decided to bring the child to full term, and once Paul was born, we proceeded then with our adoption and brought two more children into our household. And so, as far as Jenny and I can see, there are no significant social and economic constraints or pressures that make our family what it is. What our family is the product of choice and commitment, and that could change at any moment, probably. I suggest that that's a rather thin thread upon which to hang what could be 40 or 50 years of shared experience in life, considered how we're pummeled around.
Does that feel lonely, Ted?
It does. It really does feel lonely, and I think that it's a sign of the times, in a sense. Jenny's grandparents were married for 63 years, first marriage, and before they passed away. And in the time in which they got married and lived the bulk of their life, there were lots of social support, so to speak, for that kind of marriage. The social supports for today, I think, if not having evaporated, are certainly a great deal weaker than they were a generation or two before. My own forecast for the future is that there will probably be less and less in the way of external social support for marriage. People will be more and more on their own. Now, taking a look at the outline on the pink sheet, I've got another observation to make, and this is a conclusion I've drawn from my research. I'm going to state it in a slightly radical form in order to make my point. But then this leads up to some decision making and perhaps policy formation for us in our church life. My point is going to be this, that the structure of the family in the past, in the present, and in the future will be determined not by morality, not by religion, not by theology. The structure of the family will be determined by economics. And that if we think that somehow or other that through our interpretation of the Bible or our theological system that we have an order from God that the family ought to be structured in a certain way, that we may be making a big mistake. Now, let me try to give you the evidence for that. I divide the history of the world into three basic phases, this division is not peculiar to me. Others use it too. It's a slight oversimplification, but I think that it'll make my point. The first phase is the pre-industrial family, and the kind of family we had during the pre-industrial period was that of the extended family. By pre-industrial society, we mean that society from approximately 8,000 BC down to the present period of time, in which wealth comes primarily from extraction. Extraction from nature. We're talking about farming, fishing, mining, these kinds of economic activities that keep people tied to the land. And the kind of family that we have in this situation is the extended family. The family is immobile. The children, the aunts, the uncles, the grandparents all live in close proximity to one another. The kind of religious life and cultural values that crop up are values that illustrate the closeness of family ties and to the land. You get ancestor worship. You get the sense of autochthony, that is to say that the blood of the people and the nourishment of the soil are mixed together, reflected a little bit in the musical Oklahoma. You know, we belong to the land and the land we belong to is grand. Marriages in the pre-industrial period are very often arranged by the parents, not necessarily by the people who are getting married. The purpose for marriage is primarily economic, that is to say you choose a spouse who can work hard, or if you're lucky enough, you choose a spouse who will bring in a large dowry. Now, the industrial society that you and I are familiar with is probably only a couple of centuries old. The extended family has not died out, but the industrial family has marked a significant change in the structure of the family. Here, we shift the gaining of economic wealth from the land to the city, from the field to the factory. And as people move into the cities, greater and greater diversity appears. We have the rise of the professions. We have the rise of specialized institutions. Whereas in the past, the education of the children could take place by a variety of different people within the family, now education is specialized. We have a school system. And the children are sent there to be taught by professional teachers. The care of the elderly is also taken care of by professional people in nursing homes. The new feature about the family in the industrialized period is that it is mobile. It is streamlined. You get rid of the unnecessary extra baggage, the aunts, the uncles, the grandmas, and the grandpas. The family must move from one geographical location to another, and the more streamlined it is, the faster it can move. In America, since the Second World War, 20% of our population moves every year. That is to say, every 5 years, the equivalent of 100% of our population changes residence. Now, that is a lot of traveling. And it is an entirely different relationship to the land. Marriage now that we're not marrying families, but rather individuals, is based upon romantic love. And we don't want to say that romantic love didn't exist before the 18th century. Certainly it did. But it was not the criterion for marriage. Now it is the criterion for marriage, and we choose a partner in the midst of romantic love, and the benefits are not economic necessarily, but psychological value, companionship, sex, sharing of values, etc. Now, both of these forms of family still exist, and sometimes they, when they come together, there's a modest conflict, and let me give you a couple of anecdotes that I've experienced. I taught in Newberry College in South Carolina, and South Carolina is a state in which the pre-industrial form of the family is still very widespread. The people there are very close to the land, and it's still very much alive. And I had an opportunity to perform a marriage for my students. I did that often, in fact. And in this case, they were both graduating from college. He was a localite. His family lived in Newberry, and he was graduating with a bachelor's degree in business administration. She had been an army brat, traveled the world with her parents. Her father retired from the army, now lived in Evanston, Illinois, and how she made it down to the Deep South, I don't know. But at any rate, I asked them what they planned to do after they got married. And he says, well, Daddy, and that's the way they refer to their fathers in South Carolina, Daddy has a little piece of land for us. And so as soon as we get married, we'll move in with Daddy, and then we'll construct our own house, and then when it's built, we'll move out into this house, and we'll live right here in Newberry County. And I looked at her, and I said, well, how are you going to like that? Shrugs her shoulders, I guess I'll adjust. Came the evening of the wedding rehearsal, and those of you who are pastors know that that's usually a very anxiety-filled evening. And I usually find it important to get around and touch base with as many members of the respective families as I could, and I sought out the fellow who was the best man, and that was the groom's older brother, and engaged him in conversation. He told me that he's a dentist, that after graduating from dental school, he went into the U.S. Air Force. He has lived in the Orient for 2 years, lived in Europe for 2 years, and that in 6 months he's getting out of the Air Force, and he and his wife are just so pleased that now they'll be leaving the Air Force. And I said, oh, that's great. What are you going to do when you get out of the Air Force? And he says, well, we'll move in with Daddy. He's got a little piece of land for us, and after we build our house, we'll move into that house. And I said, what if we don't need any more dentists in Newberry? And he said, well, then I'll find something else to do. Now, for me, I could not understand this because I come from a classical nuclear family in Detroit, Michigan. And although it was never said in so many words, I knew in growing up that where I would live would be determined by my profession. And I remember my mother saying, oh, I hope that when you grow up, you get a job here in Michigan somewhere so we can see you. You know, and just by the very fact that she said it that way, she was resigned to the fact that my job would determine where I lived and not my family loyalty. Pushing it just a little bit further, in South Carolina, I mean, South Carolina isn't totally pre-industrial. If you may remember, when Idi Amin ousted the Indian merchants from Uganda, the Lutherans were extremely aggressive in refugee resettlement. And only a few weeks after landing in the United States, we got at Newberry College an 18-year-old Indian who had really been out of Uganda only a matter of weeks, and here he comes to college as a freshman. So he was reasonably close to his own way of life. Well, I was teaching a course in world religions, and I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a living Hindu come into class and talk with the students. So I asked him to do that. Interestingly enough, he had to call his mom and dad long distance to ask about certain worship practices. Secularism creeps into Hinduism just as it does Christianity. But at any rate, he did that, and he talked about the home shrine and Hindu worship and that sort of thing. And then the students started asking questions. And eventually it got around to dating and that kind of thing. And he said, bold-faced, without even realizing the impact it would have, he says, when I'm 22, my mother and father will go back to India, and there they will find a bride and bring her over, and we'll get married. You know? And the students said, well, wait a minute, what if you don't like her? You know? And he could not understand where the questions were coming from. It didn't make any difference whether he liked her or not. It was simply the way he was going to do it. And they all invited him out in their panel trucks for a Saturday night grasser. The next phase that the futurists are looking for is what they call the post-industrial society. What the post-industrial society will be positively, we're not sure. But one thing we are sure of is that the industrial society that we've been used to for the last two centuries is breaking down. It is giving way, and something new is coming. In particular, one of the signs is the change in the kind of work that people are doing. As of 1975, 27% of professions in the U.S. did not exist at the close of the Second World War. 27%. By the year 2000, the change, if present trends continue, will be so radical, says Daniel Bell, the sociologist at Harvard, that by the year 2000, only 8% of the American labor force will be responsible for all extraction and all industrial production. That is to say, 9 out of 10 people who work will not be engaged in farming, fishing, mining, or even in industrial production. What are these 90% going to do? Well, the general category is service professions of one kind or another. Communications, education. These are the institutions which will dominate post-industrial society. The emerging post-industrial societies are those of the United States, Canada, Japan, and Western Europe. And the more we farm out our industry, our manufacturing to second and third world countries, the more post-industrial we will become. What will be the overall impact on the value structure of American society? All of the futurists that I know of agree: increased diversity, more pluralism. You think you've had pluralism up until this point, get ready, it's going to be more and more. The mass culture, which we have experienced, influenced in large part by the mass media, CBS, NBC, and ABC, even that is going to crumble because of a whole new phase in television, which will come into existence during the 1980s, in which the programming will become local, the choice will become multiplied a hundredfold over what it is that we can do with it. Less than 50% of our television will be dominated by the networks at the end of this decade. Diversity, variety, pluralism is going to characterize our society in the next 20 years. With regard to the so-called crisis of the family, the futurists are saying that the crisis is due in large part to the breakdown of industrial society. And let's push it just a little bit further. Those people who perceive it as a crisis may be doing so because of too great an investment in the value structure associated with industrial society. The optimists would say this, that the so-called crisis of the family is not a crisis at all, but it's a problem of perception. The people who perceive it to be a crisis are those who have too great an investment in the value system associated with industrial society. Now, I don't go that far, but I do think that it's worthwhile listening to. And in a few minutes, I'll try to say why. Well, when we think of the family crisis, what are the factors that go into it? Primarily, I think probably the single most important one is the radical change in divorce patterns in our country. Between 1960 and 1976, the rate of divorce in the U.S. Tripled. From 393,000 to 1960, in 1976 we had 1 million, and since then we have had 1.2 million divorces every year. In Canada, it went up ninefold during that same period. Nine times as many people get divorced in Canada now as they did in 1960. So that statisticians can say that 40% of all of the people who get married this year will be divorced within 5 years. 45% of all of the children born now to these marriages will live a significant portion of their childhood in a single parent household. Of those people who get divorced, 5 out of 6 men and 3 out of 4 women will get remarried, and of those, 45% will get re-divorced. The so-called nuclear family, the family that became the ideal during the industrial period, mom and dad, first and only marriage, dad the breadwinner, mom the homemaker, the children living in the house, that ideal nuclear family constitutes only 17% of the U.S. households. 50% of our mothers with school-aged children are now employed. That's up from 18% in 1948. Another significant factor, especially when you think about the growing population problem of population density, is the number of people who live by themselves. Sometimes they're called singles. I prefer the word solos. We're not talking about senior citizens. We're talking about people ages 14 to 34 who are living by themselves. That has tripled since 1970. So that if you're a real estate agent, you know that 1 out of every 5 customers that you have who are looking for a place to live are going to be solos. And that's going to go up to 28 to 30% by the year 1990. Up until just a year or so ago, the number of marriages per year in the United States dropped 10% from 1970 to 1980. The number of puzzle queues, that's the census abbreviation for people, persons of opposite sex living together, that went up significantly to somewhere around 2.3 million. These changes, demographic changes, are perceived as a significant crisis. What is the source of the crisis is a question a lot of people are asking. Some people answer that the crisis is caused by pornography. Others say the practice of abortion. Some blame the crisis on rock music, some on television, some on sex education in the schools. I have a close friend who was very liberal. For a while, he had a daughter, still has a daughter, and when she was a 7th grader in sex education class, her teacher asked her to write a term paper on sexual alternatives outside of marriage, which she did, and a few months later, she moved in with a truck driver. And so he believes that sex education contributes to the crisis.
Is that true?
That's true. And he's very bitter about it. 7th grade. Buffalo, New York. While I was doing my research, the Jehovah's Witnesses came to the door and handed me an issue of Awake that was devoted to the family. The Jehovah's Witnesses blamed the crisis of the family on the new morality. Let me read this. What is the problem? Basically, it is this. Humans, flattered with their own wisdom and accomplishments, advance the idea that marriage and the family are simply of human origin, that they sort of evolved over the ages to fill a human need. But this is a serious error that is at the very root of today's disastrous family breakdown. Why so? Because love and marriage, along with the family and children, are of a higher origin. The one who created the first man and woman gave them powers of reproduction and joined them together to be a family. Then it cites Genesis and Matthew. I think there is a general tendency built right into the human constitution in general to attribute sanctity and holiness and divinity to the institution of marriage and family. That's not just true for Christians, but for people of other cultural traditions as well. The Roman Catholic Church has dubbed the marriage rite a sacrament, something that Protestants refuse to do. The Mormons teach that your marriage commitment in this world will follow you into the next world. Be careful, because whoever it is you decide to live with now, you're going to live with throughout all of eternity. I think there's a natural tendency to attribute to the institution of marriage a great deal of transcendent freight. What did Martin Luther say about marriage? He said, God has done marriage the honor of putting it into the fourth commandment. In God's sight, there is no higher office, estate, condition, and work next to the gospel than the estate of marriage. Want to know what he says about divorce? As to divorce, it is still a moot question whether it be allowable. For my part, I so greatly detest divorce that I should prefer bigamy to it. Okay, what I wanted to alert you to and try to think through here is, if we have this tendency to exalt marriage to the level of the divine, and if we are experiencing this tremendous crisis of the family that we're presently undergoing, I think there's going to be a tendency to dump a lot of moral and religious recrimination upon the people who are involved. Certainly the Jehovah's Witnesses did that in the passage which I just read. And no doubt that in many individual cases it is important to examine the morality of the matter. But if we focus our attention only there, we might miss a larger stream of social movement that has a lot to do with what's going on. And we might inadvertently place guilt where it doesn't belong. We might attribute to ourselves some guilt that we really ought not to attribute. And believe me, I don't want to make us all guiltless, but on the other hand, it's not healthy to have guilt that you don't really deserve. And I think Alvin Toffler, who is a futurist and looked at the future of the family, raises this question, and he draws an analogy between the present crisis of the family and the problem of unemployment during the Depression. And men who lost their jobs, who believed in the Protestant work ethic, had a crisis of conscience. They said, what did I do wrong? I don't have a job. I can't support my family. It must be my fault. And they had this deep sense of guilt standing, waiting in the long unemployment lines. But in the largest majority of cases, they were thrown out of work due to no fault of their own, but due to economic forces much bigger than they. And so it's with that analog in mind that Alvin Toffler writes the following. As millions of men and women clamor out of the strewn wreckage of their marriages, they too suffer agonies of self-blame. And once more, much of the guilt is misplaced. When a tiny minority is involved, the crack-up of their families may reflect individual failures. But when divorce, separation, and other forms of familial disaster overtake millions at once in many countries, it is absurd to think that the causes are purely personal. The fracture of the family today is, in fact, part of the general crisis of industrialism, the crack-up of all the institutions spawned by the second wave. Toffler's word second wave corresponds to my industrial society. It is part of the ground clearing for a new third wave sociosphere. For what we are witnessing is not the death of the family as such, but the final fracture of the second wave family system, in which all families were supposed to emulate the idealized nuclear model and the emergence in its place of a diversity of family forms. Toffler goes on then to forecast what he calls a variety or a diversity of family forms that will make their appearance more and more in the post-industrial society. He says we cannot count on there being one single model for the family that will be the source of our values. I want to mention to you the family forms that Toffler looks forward to, and in doing so, don't assume that Ted Peters is endorsing them all. I'm presenting these as information. Now, if present trends continue, number one, we will more and more recognize the solo household as a normal stage of family development. People who are solos are not likely to stay solos for their entire life. But that they may be solos for significant portions of their adult life, between marriages or before marriage, that will be considered normal. I have to think of my Aunt Edna. My Aunt Edna, I always knew growing up as my mother's sister who never got married. Until last September, at the age of 67, she married for the first time. So if Aunt Edna can do it, times are changing. Second, serial marriages, a new form of polyandry and polygamy. Polygamy, as we understand it in Africa and other such places, is one man having a variety of wives simultaneously. Toffler talks about serial polygamy and polyandry. We already have it de facto with regard to the marriage, divorce, remarriage sequence. Toffler says, well, maybe we can move to doing it consciously instead of simply falling into it. A person during his or her college years might find a spouse with whom they're going to share the common interests of education. Upon graduation, they may separate and remarry other people whose professional interests coincide with their own. When they desire to become parents and bear children, they may separate and find other spouses for the childbearing and rearing years. And then once the children have left the nest, they might choose an additional partner to live out their years of retirement. Polyandry and polygamy in a new form. Third, aggregate marriages. That is to say, two or more couples forming a single marriage bond or, at minimum, a single household. This is already going on in my neighborhood in California, and it's not due to any cultic or exotic ideology at all. It's simply economics. The price of houses is too darn high so that even people with good educations and good jobs cannot afford to live in them. And so two couples buying one house in which three professionals work and then the fourth individual stays home to take care of the children provides a way of working through that. Fourth category, homosexual marriages. That more and more homosexual marriages, says Toffler, will be recognized as a legitimate form of household. He says, and I think we'll probably all agree, there's probably a finite limit to the number of these marriages that will occur. It will not overtake the whole society. Fifth, contract or term relationships, where you commit yourself to a spouse for a period of time at which the contract is up. There is a Lutheran pastor in San Francisco who presently does this for his parishioners. He and his wife are on a one-year renewable contract, and up till this point they've renewed it each year. But he offers, if you go to him for premarital counseling, one-year contracts, five-year contracts, and if you'd like, a lifelong commitment as well. Sixth, child-free lifestyles. As I mentioned...
Oh, sounds like an ad.
Well, it's become that. As I mentioned, my wife and I had... seriously considered all of the alternatives with regard to children. We did not fall into our present pattern. There are many young couples who are just tired of cocktail parties in which diaper changes are the topic of discussion. And so there are at least three major optional parenthood clubs organized across the country. Optional parenthood is the key term to identify those married couples who do not want to have children. Now, what should the church do? Let me make some suggestions, and let me also underscore that I'm speculating here. I'm not trying to foist off upon you a new doctrine or a new dogma that I want you to believe to be the holy word of God. But I do think that we have to think through the present crisis, real or imagined, and come out the other end. And so let me propose to you some of the things that I've thought about. First, and in general, it seems to me that theologically, it is not the task of the church to prescribe to all of society the structure of family that they should have. Rather, the task of the church is to offer the kind of personal ministry, the personal caring, as an expression of God's love for us, regardless of the kind of family structure in which we find people. That's my overall theme. A, what should the church do? We should stop kidding ourselves. I have heard it said all of my life, including recently, the family that prays together stays together. That pastors and other church representatives have bragged that the church is the bastion of family support, and that somehow or other, church and family, in its most healthy sense, go together. I think it's baloney. I don't believe it. I grew up in a rather standard suburban American Lutheran church in Dearborn, Michigan. And as a child, I remember that at no time could I set foot on church property for anything other than the 1 hour worship on Sunday morning in which I was not divided and separated from the other members of my family. We had a men's fellowship, men's bowling team, men's softball team, and father and son banquets, which took the men out in one direction. We had a woman's bowling team, woman's softball team, women's circles, mother and daughter banquets, and church bazaars, which took the women out in another direction. We had the Luther League for the teenagers, the Junior Luther League for the seventh graders, and when you graduated from high school, you joined the young couples, you joined the singles club until you got married, and then you left the singles club to join the young couples club. There was nothing you could do save every July we had the Sunday school picnic. There you could go with your entire family. I didn't realize how destructive the church organization was to family life until I had been in the ministry a number of years and I observed something about the Bill Stitch family in New Orleans. Now, the Bill Stitch family thought that by serving the church, they were serving God. There was Ma and Pa Stitch and four kids. Now, on Sunday morning, they all came to church. Some had to sit in the pews and others in the choir, and others were taking care of the children in the nursery. Sunday evening, we had Luther League. One was the president of the Luther League. The older one was the young adult advisor. On two Monday nights per month, we had either committee meetings or church council meetings. That took out Pa Stitch. Tuesday night, because Ma Stitch was a school teacher, she came to the Tuesday night circle meeting. Wednesday night was choir practice. That was Mom and Dad Stitch and one of the kids. Thursday night, if we had a special Christian education program, was always supported by at least one member of the Stitch family. Luckily, Friday night, we didn't have any activities. Saturday morning, maybe a men's breakfast. That brought out Pa Stitch and son Paul. On a good week, we could keep the Stitch family separated for 6 days. Now, nobody planned it that way, but it seems to me that if the church is going to gripe that the family is going to die by the end of the century, we're going to have to accept the fact that the blood is on our own hands. Stop kidding ourselves. Secondly, do not baptize the industrial family as biblical. As I described to you, I grew up in probably a classic industrial family. And there's a natural tendency, I suppose, to believe that the whole world should live the way that we were brought up. And it's just a small move to say that it's God's will, that that's the way everybody should live. But a little look at the Bible shows that there is no one family structure that God has ordained for all people of all times and all places. There is no single model that I can find in the Bible. If you look to the early parts of the Old Testament, the great patriarchs, the greatest stories of families at all, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc., polygamy was very widely practiced. So also was the taking of concubines into one's house. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. I don't believe the Bible is necessarily advocating that we have those kinds of marriage patterns today. If you look at the New Testament, the two most important figures in the New Testament were solos, Jesus and St. Paul. So whatever it is that we want to say about the structure of the marriage, I don't think that the Bible dictates one form or another, and I don't think that we have to necessarily feel that whether it be extended family, nuclear family, or some other kind, that there's an order built right into creation that somehow or other we have to defend. For those of you who are classic Lutheran theologians, you won't like that. C, develop a more clear theology of marriage. I would like to see that, but I think that's a problem. I don't think perhaps it's possible immediately to develop a clear theology of marriage, if by that we mean we want to come up with a formula to which all of our society ought to conform. However, I would like to give you an operating definition of adultery. Thinking back now of, is what I suggested at the first, that at least in the experience of my wife and myself, and perhaps in your experience too, now that social constraints for marriage commitment are very weak, that perhaps the definition of adultery could be brought in as a support. Let me suggest this. Adultery consists in unfaithfulness to one's promise. Or to say it another way, adultery consists in doing anything that would have a tendency to destroy a family relationship. So that if we're talking about sexual relations outside of the marital commitment, if those sexual relations have a tendency to erode the strength of that commitment, then you've got adultery. Similarly, an employer who might demand all psychic and physical energy from his or her employees so that there is a direct conflict between the kind of investment that you can give to your job and the investment that you can give to your home, that employer would be guilty of adultery. D. Teach step-parenting for blended families. In working on this, I asked a friend of mine who's a family counselor in North Carolina. I said, given the church, what positive can the church do in the present situation in your experience? He said, well, the most important thing, and it's a very easy thing to do, is to teach step-parenting. He said that when step-parents come into a marriage, they do not know in advance how they ought to behave with respect to the children of the other partner. In particular, the case that he runs into again and again is a man marrying a woman who's bringing children into the marriage. And the question the man has is, how should he relate to the children? What is the nature of authority? What is the nature of encouragement, responsibility? And he said, couldn't the church provide an arena wherein those families who are experienced as blended families could share their experiences and their advice to people who are just getting married? E, integrate singles. I have a friend, good loyal Lutheran. He's about 38 years old. He's a bachelor. And despite what happened to my Aunt Edna, he probably will stay a bachelor the rest of his life. Travels the world, and everywhere he goes, he worships in a Lutheran church. And he says if he stays there for a while, they try to put him in the singles club. They won't let him in the young couples club. Anyway, the long and the short of it is, he says, they always treat me like I'm an oddball. I just want to be a member of the whole church. And a lot of singles people feel, subliminally at least, a kind of unusual status and a difficulty in terms of participating in the church as a whole. F, think of the church as an extended family. The word family, despite the present crisis, is still a good word. There's not much cynicism about it. I think the concept of the family is still a very positive symbol in most people's minds. And it seems to me that one of the things the church can do and can do well is to provide warmth and caring for people as they're undergoing the bumps and the bruises of life, as they're perhaps moving from one marriage relationship to another. Perhaps we can pick up some of the responsibilities for caring and intimacy that are needed during this period of time. I had one idea when I was a parish pastor I did not have a chance to execute, but I think if I go back into the parish, I would take a whack at it if the situation is the same. One group of people who I find really oppressed, really under the gun, are the single mothers who are raising children. Usually they're at work during the day, their children are in school, and when they get home from work, then they have to care for the children. It goes on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, week after week, month after month. There's never relief from the pressure. And the anxiety builds up, etc. The pressure doesn't get released. And they are tempted to make bad judgments with regard to getting into new relationships a second time. So hungry are they for relief. I also found in the congregation in which the idea came, we had a large reservoir of senior citizen time and energy. And it seems to me here's a natural marriage of these two groups. Why not? A weekly, if not more often, banquet in which they come together and the mothers can drop off their kids, leave, come back and get them, paint the town red, go home and have quiet time, whatever. Have ritual with regard to the shared meal, ritual with regard to evening prayer after they return late at night, and push the issue of the family. Give people symbolic family names, grandma, grandpa, aunt, uncle, etc., and so that the children are now getting some sort of leadership from people other than strictly their mother. And there may be other combinations of people that could go into this mix. And it might lead rather quickly to not necessarily going home at night. There's nothing wrong with churches, I don't think, buying apartment buildings so that they can have communal living. We already do it for senior citizens. Why can't we do it for single parents as well? And have apartment buildings in a new form of living arrangement centered right around the church. Okay, those are just my remarks and ideas, and I'm sorry I pushed you right up to the end, but I would like to solicit a few minutes of discussion before we quit. Yeah?
I had one question when you said that one of the most important things the church can do is to teach step-parenting.
Yeah.
Wouldn't an equal important step be to teach parenting?
Teach parenting?
Before it comes to teaching step-parenting?
No, that's a good thought. Practically, would this look like, say, successful, you know, is to the degree that we can judge, successful parent-children situations would be available then for other people who are about to engage in that?
Right, in the same way that the step-parenting would be done, sharing, and because so many young couples, me included, are not prepared for parenting.
Well, that's a good thought, yeah.
You know, you can't parent, but then...
Yeah, that's a good thought. Yeah, parenting is not something we should take for granted, as we have done. Margaret Mead has advocated, for example, that we have licensed parents. You have to pass a test before you're permitted to have a child. And that takes note of the fact, you know, that not all of us are going to be good parents simply because of our biological nature. Yeah, that's a good thought.
Go out of the church to learn this. I mean, you know, the community college.
Yeah. Right.
But it doesn't come from the church. Child... parent relationships usually have to go outside the church to learn. You're not going to the church.
Yeah, and again, from professionals. That's another thing about the industrial society. We really rely upon professionals. And so much about intimacy in our life is something that's caught, not taught. You know, you can't depend upon a professional to teach intimacy. And that's an important factor in parent-child relationships. Yes, ma'am?
Since I have quite a few two friends who are Christians and who are living communally, males and females together, want to ask this question. Would you limit the definition of marriage to one female and one male, or you know, a homosexual marriage, rather than a community of people marrying one another?
Well, what I'm suggesting, I think, in my whole presentation is that I would like to open up the question of marriage and look at the thing all over again. I think traditionally people do limit the word marriage to, one man and one woman. But I don't see anything intrinsic in the definition of marriage that would require that. I mean, I haven't taken the next step to positively say, you know, that all of these things ought to be considered by that Toffler lists ought to be considered marriage. You focus on the word. You know, maybe the word isn't the issue. Maybe the question is really how ought we to live, and to live in a way that's mutually edifying to one another. And I can't see anything intrinsic or, you know, from biblical or theological sources that would say that that sort of thing is basically wrong. I don't see it. And I think Roman Catholic orders, for example, now they're not bisexual, they're monosexual, but still those orders are a form of communal life, sometimes even called families, you know, and who would ever suggest that that's wrong? I mean, not me. Well, Luther did, but it was for other reasons. You know. So. Yes?
This model that you presented is based on a look into the future, the idea that our industrial society is breaking down and that we're sort of being pushed by a new economic order. Well, there's quite a lot of groups that, I think quite a majority, well, not a majority, but quite a large minority, that are really opposing that movement. Whether it's Jehovah's Witnesses, whether it's the counterculture, where people are moving away, you know, they're sort of blocking. We hear talk of labor-intensive work projects rather than industrial-intensive. What do you think that tension is going
to? You're talking generally, or with regard to the family?
With regard to the family, yeah. Are we going to have like pockets of resistance, or will that be able to? Change.
Well, Toffler in part contradicts himself when he describes the new household unit of the future will be the prosumer. That is to say, in a single household, people will be producing and consuming at the same time. I don't foresee that coming, but for Toffler, that's not resistance to the post-industrial society. That's cooperation with it.
I mean, like simple living, saying we hear a lot of that here.
That does not, because the value system is associated with the post-industrial, you know, I don't see that as resistance to it, because that actually is an example of the diversity. In other words, you're going to choose people to garden with and live with who think like you do. And so you're going to create a little group of people who have the same ideology but be very different from the commune that's over the hill from you. And there is a need for intimacy and sharing, and it's just that we'll do it not with mass culture in the post-industrial society, but rather with little groups of people who think alike. I don't think Toffler would describe that as resistance as much as another example.
Well, it seems what we're seeing now, though, is resistance, at least in the church.
But what it's resistance to, I think, in Toffler's language, in my language, is resistance to the industrial society. It's not resistance to the post-industrial.
Oh. Yeah, right. At this point, it's resistance to the industrial society.
Everybody's kicking the industrial society in the teeth. You know.
But what I guess I'm suggesting is that resistance will mount. I'm wondering if it will mount. Yeah. I sure see a lot of people making the choice to opt out now at this point. In a sense, maybe in its worst sense, in its escapism, maybe in its best sense, it's trying to form an alternative type of society.
Well, theologically speaking, I see the problem with it is this. I think our doctrine of God means that we have to think of the entire human race in a single category. And that is to say, God loves all of us. And the practical implications are, I think we need to stay in communication, stay in dialogue, and stay in mutual interdependence with the whole race. And so running off into communes which eventually will lead to narrow-mindedness, prejudice, and division and fighting. We can see the seeds. In the long run, the pluralism of that kind will lead to further destruction. So in that sense, I could see someone theologically saying, well, I'm not going to allow radical pluralism to go too far. But I haven't seen any theologians at this point, because our theologians, frankly, are not future-oriented and far-sighted. The liberation theology, which I think is very important, is an ideology that's based on the old industrial model. It's really not based on a vision of the future.
But isn't that very model what we see like in peacemaking now? Where I think the church is beginning to pull away from society as a critic of society, mm-hmm. to try and pull society this way rather than embrace the direction of, say, the arms race as trying to minister to all people, as trying to stand as a prophet. Doesn't that speak to the positive side
of
pulling out?
Yeah, the peace movement does recognize this bond with all of humanity and all of nature in its best sense. Yeah, no, and I see that. I mean, I really endorse that. And I think theologically they're on the right track.
That would seems to me that in lifestyles we're sort of in the... It can be seen that way, too.
Oh.
You know, rather than just sort of jumping on the train...
Oh, the argument, the argument that you and I should
reduce our consumption so that... That presupposes this interconnectedness, which I believe in. And I see that as much healthier than... Okay, let's go to our own commune so that when the Holocaust comes, it'll
go to Alaska because it's the last frontier.
Those are.
Yeah.
But you know, like
and
I said,
that's the extreme, more extreme expression of it. But
in various degrees, that's what people are thinking.
Pressure is forcing people into.
I have a little girl here with me that was baptized in our church here at Holden. With this, her grandmother just left the week before. We came up to Holden to go to a commune in Tennessee where they're going to wait out the Holocaust and hopefully survive.
Oh boy.
And going underground.
Yeah, I know a guy that's purchased. He was part of the engineering team that started making early missiles, and the Pentagon did a study of the air currents in the United States to decide where in the United States there would be an area where the air currents wouldn't blow the fallout.
Yeah.
And there was one place around Redding, California. Mm-hmm. He bought property there.
The other alternative is New Zealand and Australia.